We are still in Perek Bet, chapter 2. We are to Pasuk Tet Zayin, sentence 16. And I'm hoping we get to the action heroes this week, but we'll see. Those will be the Shoftim. So, we're talking about this spiral that they go through. We've already moved to the first Avera of failing to uproot Canaan. And now we're in the second one, which as a result of failing to uproot Canaan, we end up worshipping Avodah Zarah. We talked about the Baal, as well as the Ashtarot. And then the result is Hashem leaves them to the Canaanim. And that brings us to Pasuk Tet Zayin, sentence 16, which is key, because for the first time we actually find out that there is such a thing as a Shofet. After the Jews fall to the Canaanim, the Pasuk says, Vayakem Hashem Shoftim, Vayoshi'um Miyar Shosehem. So this is again sort of telling ahead the story. After they have become victims of their neighbors, Hashem appointed for them Shoftim, which we talked about in our introduction to the book, literally means judges. Vayoshi'um Miyad Shosehem. And he saved them from the raiders, the people who attack them.
How did the Shoftim know that God picked them?
Good question. Hold the thought. I'm gonna read a few psukim together. The Gamel Shoftehem lo shameyu, but this is gonna be surprising, I know. They don't listen to the Shoftim either. Kizanu achrei Elohim achirim, because the nation has strayed after the gods of others. Vayishtachavu lahem, and bowed to them. Saru maher min aderech asher alchu avosam, they have strayed quickly from the path that their ancestors walked. L'shmoa mitzvos Hashem, lo asu chen. They did not listen to the mitzvos of God. V'chi ekim Hashem lahem shoftim, when Hashem appointed judges for them. V'aya Hashem im hashofet, and God was with the judge. V'hoshiyam yadaveihem, and He saved them from their enemies. Kol yimei hashofet, throughout the life of the judge, things were good. Ki yinachem Hashem, because God... Yinachem is always a hard word to translate when you're dealing with God. But it means God changed what He was doing with them. Minakasam, because of their cries. Mipnei lochetzayhem v'dochakehem, because of those who oppress them. And then finally, v'haya v'mos ha-shofet, when the judge died, yashuvu v'hishchisu me'avosam. So what would happen is, they would then go back and do worse than what their ancestors had done. Because we're Jews, we're overachievers. So why settle for imitating what your ancestors did if you can do more? And that's a theme, you know, as you read through books like Malachim, right, where it says, and there was this king and he was even worse than all of his ancestors before him. It's, you know, setting the bar high. L'leches achrei Elohim achirim, to follow the gods of others, le'avdam, to serve them, l'shtachavos lehem, and to bow to them. Lo hipilu mima'aleihem umidarkam akasha, they didn't drop anything from their bad ways. Meaning nothing that the ancestors did was dropped. They only added, right? If you think of it sort of in terms of the complaint, the standard complaint, you know, my children are more strict than me, right? So this was like that. They were just stricter in Avodah Zarah than their ancestors were. You know, it's enough for you to go bring a carbon to the Avodah Zarah once a day. They insist on bringing the carbon to the Avodah Zarah three times a day. They won't eat my Avodah Zarah carbon. It's not good enough for them, and so on. Rescue via a shofet doesn't lead to a lasting return to God. So one of the questions we have to address is the question of, so how does the shofet know he's been picked? Right? Where, you know, how did this happen? That's one question. What else should we be wondering about?
Well, how do the people know even that they should listen to
the shofet? Right. How do they know they're supposed to listen to the shofet at all? What else?
Well, is this like a general introduction to the whole session?
Yes. Yeah, it is. It is a general introduction, and so it presents us what happens in the course of this ongoing spiral.
So how do we know that this war has happened, right?
Sorry?
They haven't yet done this.
Yeah.
So how do we know they're already telling us that
right.
It's going to be a failure?
Right, and the answer is, it's the writer of the book giving us an introduction. We already know, I think we mentioned it in the introductory weeks, that Shoftim is a crafted book. Meaning, it's not simply, I'm writing what happens in my generation, next person writing what happens in their generation. That's not what we're doing. Number one, we know that because it's recording centuries of history. So clearly it's not just, you know, a history being written through the time and being passed down, but somebody is doing this with a bird's eye view. That's number one. But number two, because some of it is out of order, not just this part, but the parts at the end are shifted out of where they happened chronologically. So yes, this is a book that is being presented in a way that's going to teach a lesson, and so it begins with this introduction by someone who has already seen the ending. One of the big questions that I always have is, what happens first? If you look at these psukim, does it sound like the Jews are being saved first, or that they do tshuva first?
It sounds like he's saving them because they were too much oppressed.
What's your evidence?
I don't know if that's... Well, he says that.
Wait a minute. Kinochem Hashem?
Right.
In 18. Mina akasam. Because they cried out.
Right.
Which could mean they cried out to Hashem, and that there actually was a form of tshuva involved.
Oh, I thought it was they were crying out.
Right, so the question is how to read that clause.
Yeah.
Do you read it as mina akasam and v'mnei lochtzeim v'doch kehem, because they cried out and because of their suffering, or because they cried out as a result of their suffering? I think you can legitimately read it either way.
They could have said something like they did tshuva.
So there actually is evidence here that they did tshuva. Look at Pasuk Yutes. After the Shofei died, then they went back and did worse than their ancestors did, suggesting that while the Shofei was alive, there had been some form of tshuva. The only question is, chicken and egg. Was it before God helped them or after? The lesson of, I think, Jewish history in general and human nature is probably that the tshuva had to be before. Because generally speaking, people don't do tshuva when things are good. It's not as though things are wonderful and they say, you know, let's go follow God. You know, generally, if things are good, we attribute it to our own success because we're wonderful people, not because God did it on my behalf. So I don't think you have a clear bit of evidence here. I don't think that you could actually read it and say definitively it's one way or the other. Rashi makes a point here, which goes back to something we discussed a little bit in the introduction. I brought it for you in number one. Rashi says, on Vayakem Hashem Shoftim, Tamid Midor El Dor, they were Shoftim continually from generation to generation. Kimoshu Mona Vaholech Besefer Azeh Shofet Achar Shofet. It should be Achar, not Achar. It must be a typo in the Bar Ilan. They were Shoftim continually, perpetually, as they're listed in the book, judge after judge. Rashi says, like Abarbanel said when we introduced the book, that there's no gap. There's no period without a shofet. There are shofetim constantly. What's the problem with what Rashi is saying based on what we're reading here? Yeah, it sounds much more like a shofet comes when they're needed. And that's the Don Mikra's approach and others who say clearly the shofet is only a response to a problem or a response to tshuva. But Rashi is adamant. There are shoftim down the line. And as I said, Abarbanel is of a similar mind. I think it's an interesting question that we're not going to be able to really resolve as much as just note the problem as we go through the book. So
he's suggesting it's like a king, there's constantly one there. It's just whether they listen to it or not.
Maybe. The problem is Vayakim sounds like it's a response, and then Hashem appointed one. It really does sound like that to me, to my ears. The other question is crying out really tshuva, or is crying out, I'm miserable, somebody save me?
Yeah.
Right? Right, well, that's the question in Mitzrayim as well. At least there it says Vayitzaku el Hashem. There you have Vayitzaku plain, and then you also have Vayitzaku el Hashem, like when it's recounted in Tehillim, Kufav, I think. It actually says they cried out to God. Here, I could legitimately read it without that. I could just read it as, you know, they were miserable. And God said, okay, fine, enough misery. Well, we're going to see a little bit of it because it's going to play out with actual shoftim and the nation
what
going
makes
through this.
Miserable? Why are they miserable? Like they're being oppressed?
So they're miserable because others will do to them what they were planning to do instead. In other words, the idea of being slaves to somebody and having to pay tribute and having them take their children away and work in their fields and whatever it is, that's all happening to them and worse. Yeah. So,
isn't that punishment?
Sorry?
Isn't that punishment from Hashem?
isn't that punishment? Yeah, well, that's what we described in the previous Pesukim, where it says Hashem sends, first it said he sends raiders from the east who just come in and take and leave, and then it talks about also the residents who just dominate them. Yes. So take a look, starting in Pasuk Chaf, Chaf to Chaf Gimel. We are going to wrap this parak. The result of that is Vayicharaf Hashem beYisrael, and we noted this last time, the expressions of divine rage, which I still want to come back to. But Hashem expresses anger against us. Vayomer, and he said, Yan Asher Avru Agoy Azes Brisi Asher Tzivisi Es Abosam. Since this nation violated the covenant that I created with their ancestors, that's problem number one. And then problem number two, Velo Shamu L'Koli, they didn't listen to my voice. Meaning, part of it is they didn't listen when their ancestors told them that we had a deal. And part of it is that aside from the deal that was reported to them by their ancestors, they didn't listen to me directly when I spoke to them. Meaning via the Shofet, presumably. Gamani lo sif larish ish mipneihem. Well, if that's the way they're going to be, then I am not going to conquer their enemies, the people Yoshua left for them. I'm not gonna conquer them. It actually says explicitly, Minagoyim Asher Azav Yoshua, those nations of Yoshua left there, Vayamos, and then he died. I'm not going after them. Abarbanel says this is not new anger from God. It's the same we saw earlier in Pasuk Yedalid, Vayicharaf Hashem, God was angry, but it's a different result. The result there was God is angry, he brings enemies. Here it's, he's angry, and he doesn't get rid of the nations that are around them. A separate problem, although fundamentally leading to the same place. One thing I found really stark in Chaf Aleph, what jumps out at you at the wording in Pasuk Chaf Aleph in sentence 21?
I feel like she's blaming Yehoshua.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Like, it sounds like it's his fault that they didn't get it.
Doesn't it sound like he's pinning it on Yehoshua? Now, you may remember, those who were here for Yehoshua will remember, that we actually discussed this problem. Well, I brought a medrash, which I brought here as well, if you take a look at source number 2, and we were really bothered by this medrash at the time, but I think our pasuk here is the answer. So you need to know more than one book in Tanakh. The number 2 here. Amar Rabbo Seinu, our sages have said, Ksif Yehoshua, kasher ha'isi Moshe ehyayimach. Hashem tells Yoshua, as I was with Moshe, so I will be with you if you follow my commandments and so on. Well, if so, v'yatzarach Yoshua l'chios kuf chav shana k'moshe Rabbeinu, so Yoshua should have lived to be 120. Moshe got to be 120. Why doesn't Yoshua get to be 120? It's a good question, bless you. Don't start me on the whole 120 thing. We've discussed that before. But but Yoshua was told, I'll be with you like I was with Moshe. V'laman iskatsu shno sav yud shanim, so why does he only make it to 110, poor guy? The Medrash says, you know, God told Moshe, take revenge for the Jews against Midian for what they did, and then you will be gathered to your nation. Even though Moshe was told, after you fight against Midian, that's it, the story's over, you're gone. Nonetheless, Moshe does not delay. Yelan is dareis, just the opposite. He was energetic. Vayishlachosam Moshe. Moshe sent them, and so forth. Abo Yoshua, kevin shabali ilachem im lamad aleph malachim. When Yoshua came to fight against the 31 kings, Omar, he said to himself, you know, emani argam miyad. If I kill them right away, miyad ani meis. Kishem shasam Moshe Rabbeinu. He says, nah, you know, that's it for me. My mission will be over. How he knew that is a good question. But he says, that's it for me. So I'm not going to fight against them just yet. So what did he do? He delayed in their battle. And it quotes a pasuk from Parakeet Aleph and Yoshua. Yoshua fought against them for many days, meaning years. Hashem says to him, that's what you do. You lose 10 years. So there.
Why does it say, just like I'll be with Moshe, I'll be with you, why does that have to refer to your age?
Mm-hmm.
It could be referring to their relationship. It could be referring to anything. Why does it specifically mean?
What is motivating this medrash? Is it really just that he lived a shorter life than Moshe did? That's really strange. That's a very hard thing. Not to mention, we read this medrash when we did Yoshua Parakeet Aleph.
Yeah.
That pasuk. The pasuk which says, for many days Yoshua battled all of these kings. Does that sound like he was stalling?
But maybe it does. Let's see.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I don't think this is a medrash on Sefer Yehoshua. I think this is a medrash on Sefer Shoftim. That's often the trick when you're learning medrash, is to figure out what is this a medrash on? What pasuk is stimulating this idea? And even though the pasuk they quote is the one from Yehoshua Yud Aleph, I think what's really motivating it is our pasuk here, where Hashem says, all those nations that Yehoshua left, as though it's Yehoshua's fault, and the Medrash is picking up on that and saying, aha, Yehoshua is to blame, and then it ties it into the fact that, see, he doesn't live as long as Moshe did. Remember that we take Moshe's lifespan as a sign of his righteousness, right? The fact that he doesn't lose any of his health down to the end, we talk about that as an element that demonstrates the righteousness of Moshe, the fact that we say that he says, Ben Esrim, Ben Me'av Esrim Shana Anochi Hayom. He says, 120 years old today. So the Medrash says, you see that tzaddikim live full years. They get to be, you know, they get to live to the day they were born. So that's the to me that's what's motivating this Medrash, is the fact that our pasuk says that Yehoshua that's Yehoshua who left them. Okay, so Hashem says, I'm going to leave them there to test the Jews, and that's what Hashem does. He doesn't conquer them in Yehoshua's day, because the Jews didn't fight. He doesn't conquer them now either, because the Jews became Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They became idolatrous. And that's what concludes the Perek. Two overarching questions. Right? Did we read Chaf Ben and Chaf Gimel?
No.
Okay, then we'll read Chaf Ben and Chaf Gimel first. Sorry. Leman nasos bames Yisrael. Hashem left them there to test the Jews. Hashomrim heim es derech Hashem lalech es bam. Will they follow the path of God to walk in the ways God has instructed? Kasher shamru avosam, as their ancestors did, imlo or not. Vayanach Hashem es hagoyim ha'ele, and God left these nations, levalti harisham maher, not conquering them quickly, v'lo nesanam biyad Yehoshua, and he did not give them to Yehoshua. And that's the conclusion of the parak.
So isn't that a problem? Because, I mean, like, it's like, it's God's decision. That it's, I mean, he's saying he chose not to deliver the Jews.
Right.
So it's not his fault.
Right. So what it sounds like is that both of these are penalties. The one in the days of the Shoftim is because the Jews became idolatrous. The one in Yehoshua's day is because they didn't conquer them back then. In other words, there's a different reason for why Hashem leaves them at different times. That's the way that I understand what's going there in the pasuk. But yes, part of it is the problem which we pointed out in the beginning of this chapter, was this such a repetitive chapter that it's hard to sort of pick it apart and identify the structure. But I think that's what's going on, and that's the way that the commentators generally take it. So I had two questions. Question number one is, are the Jews really never good? Like, is that it? Shoftim is just 400 years of horror? Is that what we're supposed to take away from here? And then the other question, which we started on last time a little bit, is the question of what in the world it means for God to be angry. Like, how do you describe God as angry? God is not a human being. So, first question first. Are they never good? If you take a look at Pasuk Yitzayin, right, sentence 17, it sounds like they never listened. Right, saru maher is actually a loaded phrase. Where does saru maher come from?
Yeah,
Ooh, close. Not that far apart in Plumish, though. Saru maher, the phrase in Pasuk Yitzayin. Who is described in Chumash as being saru maher? They had the chidon this morning. Hopefully she's resting right now. They strayed quickly.
What to do with ego?
You got it. Hashem says to Moshe, Lech rei kishichei samcha asher halisa mimitzrayim, go descend, because your nation that you took out of Egypt has become corrupt, right? That's the classic, right? It's like the father says to the mother, look what your kid did. So Hashem says, asher halisa mimitzrayim, the ones you took out of Egypt, right? In the Haggadah, he's happy to say, ani v'lo malach, right? But suddenly after the Egel, it's your nation. But he says, they strayed quickly from the path I commanded them. So here, Shoftim is saying that's what the Jews are like in the time of the Shoftim. They don't listen. However, Pasuk Yutet, I pointed out before, sentence 19, makes it sound like they listened during the lifetime of the Shofet, and they only stopped when the Shofet died. So it's unclear. Malbim notes this. He says it seems like they're good during the time of the Shofet's own life. So the Maharzu is a commentary to Medrash Rabbah. And, well, he was the author of the commentary to the Medrash Rabbah, to be fair. But he says there were times when they listened during the time of the Shofet, and there were times when they did not listen during the time of the Shofet. You know, you could always just say, you know, we're complicated people, and sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. But he says there are different generations. And there were times when they listened to the Shofet, and then after the Shofet died, they strayed. And there were times when they just didn't listen, and the Shofet could be yelling his head off, and it wouldn't make a difference. And he points to the Medrash, which I brought you, in number 3. Medrash on Sefer Rus. Vayihi bimei Shfot HaShoftim. This is a classic, right? Because you could translate the phrase Shfot HaShoftim in two ways. Shfot HaShoftim could be when the judges judged, or it could be when they judged the judges. So the Medrash prefers the latter reading and says, Oy ledor sheshaftu es shofteihem, woe to a generation which judges its judges. Voy ledor sheshoftav tzrichin lihishafetim, woe to the judges, woe to the generation whose judges need to be judged. Right? There's a reason they end up in court. The meaning that there were times when the judges themselves were not worthy. Now that raises the question we discussed in the beginning of the book, in our introduction, of were all the Shoftim wonderful people? This Medrash seems to think, no. There were Shoftim who were good, and there were Shoftim who maybe were not so good. Maybe there were no good ones. Maybe this is the best of a bad lot. You know, this is what you have.
Also,
did
they
call I'm so dying to see them at US election. Yeah, go ahead. Different
terms of office, so to speak, right? Like some lasted a lot longer.
Some lasted a very long time and some did not last
and
at all.
Tranquility in certain periods, right? Like 40 years, 80, you know.
Right.
So they were good probably for those times, right?
So it's hard. I mean, I'm bringing this up as an ongoing question within the Sefer. I don't think there are definitive answers to it. But as we're going to see, some of the Shoftim really are going to push this question of, really, that's the best God could come up with? We'll see it through the book. And the view that says, no, the Shoftim are all wonderful people, is a tough view in light of not just this Medrash, but the stories we're going to see. So that's something to keep in mind. Yeah.
What about the they? Like, all of B'nai Israel were bad? I mean, in Mitzrayim, a certain minority were worthy of leaving. Everybody in B'nai Israel was all bad during the time of the Shoftim?
So that's part of this whole question of what's, you know, what is it that's going on here? Is it that some of them were good and some of them were bad? Right now, it sounds like they've all gone native. They've all become like the Canaan around them. Hard to accept. Yeah. The other question is this business of God being angry, which we've referred to multiple times in this parak. We saw it back in Pasuk Yud-Bet, sentence 12. We saw it in sentence 14. So the simple explanation, as Rambam likes to say, is that we're describing God's actions as they appear to us. Meaning, God looks angry. He acts angry. Leba suggested last time that God expresses anger only with us. Maybe like it's a function of our relationship. God doesn't care to express anger at Canaan. So I actually looked after the class, and the only times you find the expression of Vayichar, that Hashem was angry, is with the Jews, except for one. There has to be one. The exception is Bilam. The only exception is Bilam, where it says that Hashem gets angry at Bilam when he insists on going. Now, you could argue that Bilam also has something of a relationship. You know, he has Nivuah. Hashem has chosen him and made him into a Navi. So you can still retain the idea. When you write your Perush on Navi, you can use it. So that could be the explanation. The answer could really be Hashem displays anger because we have a connection with him, and this is, you know, Hashem's way of saying, you're ruining the relationship. That's one way to look at it. But I wanted to just note on this, because I think it's an important point as a greater theme when you read Tanakh, the idea of anthropomorphizing God, right? That we are going to describe God in human terms, which, as we noted last week, goes beyond anger. It's something that we talked about, I mentioned before, regret, right? By Inachim, the idea of God regretting. The usual explanation for why we do that is that it's l'saber es ha'ozen. It's done in order to make something more comprehensible to us, so that we can understand it better. But that's always been a difficult explanation for me, because would it really be hard to understand the pasuk if it simply said, God punished us? Did you need the phrase, God got angry, in order to convey that we had, you know, disobeyed God? You follow my problem? When we say that, oh, it's done that way in order to make it more comprehensible, I think it was comprehensible when we said that God, you know, gave us into the hands of the raiders and they enslaved us. I thought that was pretty clear. I think the value of anthropomorphizing God is that it makes relating to God and therefore following God easier.
It's stronger.
It is stronger.
I mean, it's stronger if someone's punishing you because they're upset than just punishing you because that's what they feel like they should do. I mean,
true.
Like if you do something, wrong, and this is what's supposed to happen, and you're just going through the motions. Whereas if you feel that negative impact coming from above, like the negative.
But you can describe something false in order to convey the strength of it, because God's not angry. There's no such thing as anger for God.
Well, what about in today's day when they try to when you say Sadi Baralo? So maybe certain things have to happen, and there could be punishments, but it's not necessarily because God is angry.
So that
maybe
not
that, meaning so, well, no, maybe someone was getting a punishment, but it wasn't necessarily because God was angry. So if it is because God's angry, they have to say that.
So in other words, there are times when God is going to punish, leaving aside Sadi Baralo overall.
Well, that's the only example I have, though. I don't know why I'm saying
no punishment when God's not angry.
Well, I think that it's important to distinguish between suffering and punishment, because I think you're using them to mean both. I think there are times when people suffer and it has nothing to do with punishment.
No, I agree with that. I'm saying, but is it always a punishment when God is angry? There's never a punishment when he's not angry?
I don't know. I don't know. The way we describe it, and we use the phrase over and over again in Tanakh, you know, is there a time when we find God zapping the people, and it doesn't say, Vayichar? Yeah, probably. That's a safe bet, although, you know,
horrible concept.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, isn't this like a parent, right? Like, a little kid, as an analogy, the mother could say, just punish them. But for him to understand it, you have to say, I'm angry at you. I mean, also, yeah. Or you, what you did is wrong, so the child, and if the child can relate to it, but I think it's more for the people
right. To
relate to it more so.
I don't know, but you can punish without being angry.
Exactly.
A parent can punish without being angry. You're not necessarily angry, you don't really care.
And to
but
take that even,
the,
yeah.
You still have
to
the punish for teaching.
To take that even further, when a parent punishes when they're angry, it ruins, it has an effect on the relationship in a negative way. When the parent punishes, you know,
as a teaching,
it kind of salvages it,
right.
It saves the relationship.
Right.
You know, it kind of separates the.
Right. I think I mentioned last week the position of the Rambam, where the Rambam says that you're never supposed to get angry at your child, but sometimes you need to display anger in order for them to understand that something is serious.
Right. So maybe that's what's happening.
That's always for me. I would never actually get angry. I'm not angry. I think it's true that there can be a time when God says, you broke the rules, you have to be punished, and it's not such an emotional thing for me, so to speak. But that just begs the question of so what does it mean when it says God gets angry? Because God is not supposed to get angry ever. There's no such thing as anger for God. I brought you the Rambam in number 4, right?
That's what brings more gravity to the using that word angry brings more importance or shows how severe.
But why would you say something that isn't true in order to simply convey what they did this time was really bad?
They can't relate any of it.
Isn't an Aruch HaPaim flow to anger?
Yes.
So he's slow to anger when he gets angry.
No, but again, they're going to say slow to display anger will be the way that the Rambam will read it.
Right.
There's no such thing as anger. It is always a display. So I think the idea is that you need to have a feeling that there's a personal connection to God. In order to draw close to God, the idea of ahava, of love of God, the idea of yira, of reverence for God, can't happen if God is a computer program, so to speak. You know, there's a divine computer, and it, when you do something wrong, it's going to zap you. When you do something good, it's going to help you. There's nothing there that you can connect to. You know, there's no affection. There's not. You need to express it in this way, because that's the way that human beings will be able to develop a relationship with God. They need to perceive it as emotional. They need to feel that there's an investment.
Why not say that? Why not say he appeared angry or he acted? Like, why not say that? Like,
because
why not?
Because it loses force.
But then it allows us to build the angle. So they needed something physical.
Well, that's a question, because those people haven't been brought up on this whole anger thing.
From God, they got really mad at God when they built that angle there. Now we're saying he wasn't really angry, and plus they built the angle because they needed something physical.
Right.
And we're giving God a physical attribute because it's easy to relate to him. He's got a physical attribute.
It's okay.
The door of the eagle also needed something physical to relate to.
Right. And the question is that really what the eagle was about? I mean, I think from the psukim, it's very arguable that the most literal read of it is that they wanted to replace Moshe. Because, for any number of reasons, the psukim lead in that direction. Like, for example, the fact that they came to Aharon. Right? If you want to build an idol, you don't go to Aharon. Right? It's like going up to the rabbi and saying, "Rabbi, can you hold my car keys for me?" I have a story with that, but I won't tell it on audio. My rabbi days. This was great, but I can't tell it right now. But you don't go to Aharon and say, "Create an idol." Why do they go to Aharon? Because Aharon was the one who brought them Moshe in the first place.
They want another one.
Yes, we broke this one. Can you bring us another one? I'm not kidding. Look at what they say to him. They say, "Kizem Moshe ha'asei lanu Elohim asher yochul lefaneinu." Make a powerful being who will walk before us. Kizem Moshe ha'ish, because Moshe, the man, asher holenu me'aretz Yitzrayim, who took us out of Egypt, lo yodanu mahayala. We don't know what happened to him. He's gone. So make us a more powerful version of Moshe this time, because the last one, we broke him. That's the story that's going on, and it fits very well in terms of several different pieces. But I think this is about needing to have that relationship with Hashem. Take a look at what I brought you on number 5 from the Rav, from Rav Soloveitchik. It's a separate point. He's not dealing with our question, but he's dealing with the problem of piyutim. Right? Piyutim are the poems that get inserted in the davening at various times of year. Depending on how Ashkenazi you are, they will be more prevalent in your davening or less, meaning that classic Ashkenaz had them on the Dalet Parshios leading up to Pesach, to Purim and Pesach. They have special ones for Shkalim and for Zachar and whatnot in different times of the year, and then aside from the ones that fill your machzer for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, unless you daven at the Bayit, in which case you save about 10% of them. But all these piyutim are problematic. Well, they're problematic for various reasons. But one of the problems with them is that they tend to anthropomorphize God very heavily. And the Rambam would never have accepted that what we do with these piyutim. So take a look at what the Rambam writes in number 5. He says, "Halachic man never accepted the ruling of Maimonides opposing the recital of piyutim." The Rambam didn't say this against the piyutim per se, but never accepted this idea of the Rambam that you can't describe God in these anthropomorphic ways. The liturgical poems and songs of praise. "Go forth and learn what the guide," meaning the Moreh Nevuchim, God of the Perplexed, "sought to do to the piyutim of Israel. Nevertheless, on the high holidays, the community of Israel singing the hymns of unity and glory," Reishia Kavod, Anim Zmiros, "reaches out to its creator. And when the divine presence winks at us from behind the fading rays of the setting sun, and its smile bears within it forgiveness and pardon, we weave a royal crown of praise for the Atik Yomin, the ancient one. And in moments of divine mercy and grace, in times of spiritual ecstasy and exaltation, when our entire existence thirsts for the living God, we recite many piyutim and hymns, and we disregard the strictures of the philosophical midrash concerning the problem of negative attributes and how can I describe God and describe God based on what he's not. We throw all of that out the window and just describe God as though God were sitting in front of us. That's just what we do. Because that's the way that we relate to God. And without it, we lose the relationship. And I think that's the idea of all of these references to divine rage, is that it makes the relationship with God much more accessible to us. I think that's what's going on. Yeah. No, we talk about God as loving us also. Kia evecha, Hashem Elokecha. Right? Hashem has loved you. Sorry. Yes, we have rachman from Hashem. We have nichum. We have regret. Yeah. No, is it, God isn't a one emotion figure in Tanakh. Yeah. Okay. So that concludes Perek Bet, Chapter 2. We talked about, if you remember, we have the Navi who comes to them, who we think is Pinchas, appears like an angel, contrasting him with the Jews who he was warning about the Canaanim. We saw that knowledge is insufficient to keep the next generation from straying. Knowing what God has done in the past doesn't help. You need to actually see it. You need to experience it. The two sins, keeping the Canaanim around and that leading to Avodah Zarah. And then this question of, so how bad were they? Were they all bad? Were they bad in every generation? What were the Shoftim? Are the Shoftim good? We can't answer these questions, you know, definitively. And then finally, this issue of the divine rage. So that brings us...